Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's wonderful dot foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. We're going to be listening today to an interview with Mark Shapiro, who's written a marvelous book called Exposed, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products and What's at Stake for American Power. But before that, I would like to let people know that this is the first day, the first weekday of the KSFR Fun Drive, and that is the time of year where we ask you to go to your telephone, call the number 428-1393, 428-1393, and make a contribution to KSFR. KSFR in general, and the Santa Fe Radio Cafe in particular. We want you to vote for the shows that you like, and if you like this show, and I know a lot of people who are listening tell me that they like this show and that they listen to it a lot, well, the time has come to pay for it. The way you pay for it is you make a contribution within your means, whatever isn't going to hurt you, 428-1393. I was thinking about it on the way in, and I was thinking about the distinction between what you have to do and what you want to do. You have to earn a living. You have to get up in the morning, most of us. You have to eat if you want to live. But then there are things that you want to do. You want a car to get around, or you might want a bicycle, or you might want certain things like a pair of shoes or whatever. You have to pay for them. You also want to listen to KSFR Public Radio. If you wouldn't, you wouldn't have it on right now. You want to listen to this program in particular because for a lot of you, it brings you in touch with people and ideas that you wouldn't be in touch with otherwise. Well, you have a choice to pay for that. But if you don't, the station cannot keep going. So think about what the show means to you and what the station means to you and make a contribution to KSFR. 428-1393 is the number. Dal Dearman is with us in the studio.
I'm here. Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Are people rising to the occasion this morning as they rise out of bed?
People are rising to the occasion. We've had some good phone activity. In fact, I have someone to thank right now. I want to thank both a member of the Santa Fe Community College trustees and a very good friend of KSFR, Bruce Besser, has just made a contribution. Thank you so much, Bruce. Good to know you're there listening. And Mary Charlotte, I just want to say what a venerable Santa Fe institution the Radio Cafe has become under your tutelage.
Tutelage.
Under your hosting. It's just a great show, and you're right. So many people tell me how much they enjoy it. One of the things that I find just fascinating about it is the variety of guests, both local and national and international, that you've had in the baking company over the last few years. Just all people from all kinds of parts of the culture and all kinds of parts of the news. And I wanted to ask you who some of the most memorable interviews you have might have been.
Well, because my brain has a limited storage capacity, I can't remember anything before about 3 days ago. But no, that's not quite true. But I have to say the most memorable ones right now, one of them is the one we're about to hear. I won't explain it in tremendous detail because the interviewee, Mark Shapiro, does a tremendous job with that. But it was absolutely fascinating to me to hear not only about the reality of toxic chemicals in our environment, but the tremendous differences between Europe and the United States and the way that they deal with them. So that's what we're going to hear in just a couple of minutes. There are many more that we've had really on all subjects from the whole realm of science, from global warming on, and we're going to be doing actually quite a bit more science programming on this show, to people talking, looking back and talking about their lives. We've had some wonderful elders on this program like Mary Lou Cook. We have a lot of people who are local, who are involved in culture in one way or the other, doing plays or doing comedy or doing music, who are living in Santa Fe or who are passing through Santa Fe. We try to get them all on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe for you, the listener.
Well, I always like to say about the cafe that it's for people, you know, it's about people you know and people you'd like to know.
That's sort of true, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The number to call is 428-1393. We're going to start our interview in just a second with Mark Shapiro, but please call and make a contribution. Vote for the Santa Fe Radio Cafe with your contribution. If you contribute $35, you're going to get the full CD of today's interview with Mark Shapiro, which is longer than what we're going to be able to play today. If you contribute $100, you will get this wonderful book, which I have been talking about to all my friends nonstop over the last few days since we did the interview. And if you contribute $125, you will get both the book and the CD.
Unabridged.
Unabridged, that's right. The unabridged CD and the unabridged book. Call right now, 428-1393. I'd like to introduce now, on disc, Mark Shapiro, the author of the book Exposed, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products and What's at Stake for American Power. Mark Shapiro is the editorial director of the Center for Investigative Reporting in San Francisco. Let's hear it. This book is in large part about the contrast between Europe and the United States and the way in which we deal with environmental protection. Describe where we are in relation to Europe. What are the differences in the approach that we take to regulating and protecting people from the toxic materials in our world?
Well, that is a very good question and a central question. The United States, really over the past 7 or 8 years, has fallen behind what most of the world is doing when it comes to environmental protection. So now here in the United States, we have, I've looked at a number of elements to this in my book, one of which, a major part of which, is the question of chemicals. How do we handle chemicals in everyday products and such? And what I found out was that the United States permits an incredible array of substances that are widely considered to be toxic substances to be used in everything from toys to automobiles to cosmetics. And those same products, products, in Europe, for example, don't have those substances. So the European Union applies something called the precautionary principle. And they look at scientific evidence, and they basically look at accumulation of evidence. And if the evidence starts suggesting that there could be real harm from a substance, they require that it be removed. They ban it. In the United States, we do not have the precautionary principle. We have a system that essentially has to definitively prove the toxic qualities of a particular chemical. And when I say definitively, I mean definitively prove in the realm of science, as many of us probably know, is a near impossibility. Science is itself a fantastic enterprise where one conclusion leads to another question, leads to another conclusion, and on and on. And so the United States, however, has created this almost impossible barrier to meet of proving definite harm before being able to act, as well as a number of other things such as cost-benefit, are the benefits greater than the cost, et cetera, et cetera. So the result is that in product after product, you've got highly toxic chemicals. I mean, we're seeing, you know, things like phthalates in children's toys that are endocrine disruptors, are used in toys that children can suck on, allowed to be used here in the U.S., banned in Europe. Other substances that are carcinogenic substances in cosmetics, banned in Europe, allowed to be used in the United States. And one after the other, and I talk about this in my book, we've got a situation where Americans are being exposed to toxic substances that the rest of the world, that much of the world, and most of the developed world is following the Europeans' lead now, are protected from.
You describe a double standard in which large American companies complying with European regulations in Europe are still making the argument that the same standards are overly burdensome when similar regulatory legislation is introduced in the U.S.
Exactly. And in my book, I describe going to the headquarters of a major multinational cosmetic company. And I went to the research center for a major cosmetic company based in its European operations based in Brussels. And listen to them as they told me how they were taking toxic substances out of their cosmetics. The Europeans had passed a law requiring that chemicals that cause cancer, that mutate genes, and that disrupt the reproductive system be removed from cosmetics. Now, who knew there were such chemicals in cosmetics to begin with? We certainly had very little idea here in the United States that such chemicals were in hundreds and hundreds of cosmetic products. And one of the ways we learned that, or I learned that, and any consumer can learn it as well, is because the Europeans published a list. And they published a list of chemicals that are forbidden to be used in cosmetics sold in Europe. And that list contains hundreds of substances that are either carcinogens, mutagens, or reproductive toxins. So I'm there in this very nice research center for this big, large company, and they're telling me that they are adapting to this situation because they have a huge European market. And so what have they been doing? They've been taking chemicals out of their cosmetics. And then a couple of weeks later, I fly back to California. I live in California, and I went to a hearing at the California State Senate where a bill had been introduced to essentially require cosmetic companies to tell the state what kind of chemicals they had in their cosmetics. And this very same company was fighting, was one of the top lobbying forces in the state capitol, fighting a measure that was essentially a tenth as strong as the Europeans' measure. So within the same, essentially, like, 6-week period, you had two very different approaches being taken by one company. So what we're seeing is this kind of emergence of a double standard when it comes to environmental protection.
Where is the United States Food and Drug Administration on the safety of cosmetics?
Well, the Food and Drug Administration basically does not exist on the question of safety of cosmetics.
Is there anybody that regulates the safety of cosmetics and creams and all this stuff that we, especially women, put on ourselves?
Well, the FDA has some limited power to look at hair dyes. That's the one area that they do have some power in. But when it comes to the 95% of other cosmetic products, the cosmetic industry has no independent body overseeing their operations. So these substances that you apply to your skin and to your body and such, basically nobody, I think most women, not to mention men, might presume that somebody has certified the safety of these products before they go on the shelf. And that is incorrect. It's an illusion. And I think it's an illusion that many Americans share, partly because we like to think we have faith in our government and they're looking out for our interests. But I think on the questions of chemicals in these and other products, that is absolutely not the case. So when it comes to cosmetics, the industry, when this was raised, and it has been raised several times over the 60, 70 years existence of the FDA, when there have been efforts to regulate the ingredients in cosmetics, the cosmetic industry has repeatedly fought those efforts back and instead said that they would regulate themselves. So what you now have is a situation where the Cosmetic Trade Association, Cosmetic Fragrance and Trade Association, basically sponsors a meeting every couple months of scientists who are supposed to be looking at the ingredients in cosmetics and providing recommendations to companies as to whether or not they should use them. Now, that sounds fine, except when you realize that, number one, this is nothing but a recommendation, and I have numerous examples in my book and elsewhere of recommendations made by the industry's own scientists where the industry has not responded. And two, compare that to what happens in the European Union. In the European Union, every quarter, a group of scientists meet from toxicological institutes across Europe, and they assess the toxicity of certain of the substances. They determine what is and what is not toxic, and that goes straight into the governing authorities in the European Union, which act to either put it or remove it from the negative list, which is of prohibited substances. So you have very, very different systems at work in these two places that are basically the same economic affluence level and such like that, extremely different systems at work. And the result is that I think Europeans are far more protected than Americans from substances, many of which are sold by the same companies.
One thing that's very worrisome is that because a lot of the products that are made in the United States cannot even be allowed to be sold in Europe because they don't meet European standards, does that mean that we are the only market for them and therefore we are basically the guinea pigs for these toxic products?
Well, that, I'm afraid, is indeed what's happening. Is indeed what's happening because the European Union has passed these laws. It's cosmetics, it's toys, it's automobiles, it's electronic devices, thousands and thousands of things that we engage with on a daily basis. And so where are you going to go when you can't hold on to this market of almost 500 million people? Where are you going to come to the United States? And we're seeing a lot of these. This is a very powerful example, I think. We just went through this whole difficult couple weeks here with the lead, with the recall of toys. And, of course, that kind of shines a light on this whole question. What I think is interesting is to consider the toxic substances that we knowingly allow to come into the United States. So this was kind of ostensibly a surprise in terms of discovering that there was lead in toys. But every day we're allowing toys in with substances that we know are toxic, and that includes phthalates. So phthalates are a substance that softens plastic. And for kids, it makes it very soft and pliable, so kids can bounce it around and suck on it and just have fun with little toy giraffes and
rubber
like that.
Rubber duckies and whatnot.
Rubber ducky, yeah, the ultimate rubber ducky, right. So a mounting body of evidence suggests that phthalates, what do they do in the first year or two after birth? Well, they decrease the production of testosterone, which you don't have to be a scientist to figure out that it's not something you want decreased early in life, and has an effect on essentially the development of the sexual reproductive system of young males. So the European Union has looked at a stream of evidence for some years now, and about 6 or 7 years ago, banned the use of phthalates in toys. So you go to Europe, no phthalates in toys. They don't exist, and the industries have found alternatives. The United States looked at essentially the same evidence, because much of this evidence comes from international research institutions, many of which are located here in the United States. So they look at the same evidence. The American authorities are looking at all this abundance of evidence, and the European authorities are looking at this abundance of evidence, and the United States decided to do nothing about phthalates. So what you have is a situation where I've been following confiscations in European customs authorities. And every week, the European Union reports the products that they've confiscated from the shelves of European retail outlets. And among them, every month at least, is a confiscation of toys from China with phthalates. And I can tell you, they described last July, there was a shipment of toy hippopotamus that was confiscated from the stores in Lithuania. And there it is, confiscated, taken right off the shelves, and said, we don't permit this substance to be sold within the European Union. So that product's been recalled in Europe. Now, where do you think that's going to go?
Perhaps to Walmart?
Could be. This is where the market is. The United States, as well as all the other countries that don't regulate phthalates, which would be places with far less even regulatory, Cameroon and, you know, places with no regulatory protections at all. So we're in the situation now of basically becoming a dumping ground for products that are being refused elsewhere around the world.
And you're listening to KSFR, the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. And guess who we have right here in the, believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, in the cafe is the author himself. Mark Shapiro has stopped by. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's great to be talking to you about your book and then having you actually come by. It's sort of a coincidence that you're in Santa Fe right now.
It's a total coincidence. I'm actually speaking tonight at an event not far from here, and was driving in with my friend Bob Martin, who's at your own Lensic Theater early this morning, to hear my own interview being heard on the radio here in your local station was just a thrill.
Which we recorded last week when you were in San Francisco. This is the time where we're asking people to go to the telephone to call 428-1393, 428-1393, and make a contribution of $100 and get a copy of this marvelous book by Mark Shapiro, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products and What's at Stake for American Power. You can also get a copy of the CD of the unabridged interview, of which we're not going to get to the whole thing, by making a contribution of $35, or you can get a package deal for both of them by contributing $125. But whatever you can contribute, even if it's only $10, call right now, 428-1393. Mark Shapiro, you're a public radio listener?
Oh, totally, man. Every morning.
You listen in San Francisco.
I live in San Francisco. And the first thing I do when I get into a new city, because I've been traveling a lot lately, is I ask the local people what's the best public radio station I can get a hold of. And, of course, I did that here in Albuquerque. I was reading yesterday at Bookworks, and I asked them, I'm going to Santa Fe. What's the best station I can listen to? And I'm not making this up. They told me you got to listen to 90.7, which I put it on, and, of course, heard the station coming in all the way to Santa Fe yesterday.
Well, that's good, because we're working on our signal, and the 101.1 FM signal, thanks to contributions of our listeners, is now extending almost all the way to Albuquerque, and 90.7, maybe about halfway. What is the value of public radio to you, Mark Shapiro?
The value, I'm a journalist, so I'm interested in how the world works, and I actually want to get as close a portrait to what is happening as possible. So I listen to public radio because that is where where you get information. You know, we've just gone through a pledge drive in San Francisco, and I did a pledge drive thing at one of the local radio stations there. So in a way, as I say this, I could hear it sound kind of canned, because your listeners have always heard this for a day now. They're hearing how people extol public radio. But
the problem is it's true.
The problem is it's true. So I'm trying to say this in as convincing a way as possible, that public radio is absolutely critical to the free flow of information, to getting information you would never get elsewhere. And that is absolutely true in terms of...
Well, you as an investigative journalist, you are the editorial director of the Center for Investigative Reporting in San Francisco. I mean, is what are the outlets on radio for the type of investigative journalism that you do? Is it always public radio? Is it mostly public radio?
It is only public radio. In fact, we do a lot of work with American Radio Works. We do hour-long documentaries for American Radio Works. In fact, I'm doing one right now with them. They produce hour-long docs. Where are they distributed? On national public radio. We do work with NPR, and some of our pieces get on NPR. The national public radio system. And so there is really, when you are a journalist, nowhere else to work in this country than on public radio, and with stations like this one in Santa Fe.
428-1393 is the number, 428-1393.
Mary Charlotte?
Yes.
Also, the toll-free number, 866-907-5737.
866-907-5737.
Got a couple of people to thank real quick.
Excellent.
Our good friend Diane Karp, KSFR is fabulous, Diane says.
Wonderful.
Lisa Rawlings.
Thank you.
And we need the phone to ring.
Please call right now. All listeners to this program, call and make a contribution. 428-1393 is the number. We're going to return right now to the interview with Mark Shapiro, but don't forget, call 428-1393 or 1-866-907-KSFR. We'll be back in a little while.
One interesting point in your book is that a real difference between the United States and European systems is that we have a heavier reliance on the judicial system to essentially effect regulation through the process of lawsuits. Does this work for things like toxins and environmental toxins?
Well, that is very interesting, and there is something at the heart of the differences in Europe and America. What the United States has is a very lively tort system. So you can file lawsuits when there are problems with products and allege that a company caused harm. Two things about that situation. Number one, and that is true, and an enormous amount of progress has been made as a result of lawsuits. DES and Ford's engines and the Vioxx cases now are going through the courts. But number one, at the heart of that question is dealing with the problem after it surfaces. It takes an enormous amount of effort to prove in a court of law the toxic effects of a particular substance. So basically at the heart of that approach, it causes punishment to a company or a producer of these problems after the fact, number one. Number two, the European Union is a very different approach. They take their precautionary principle approach. They do not have a lively tort system. They do not have an ability to catch major damages from companies that are creating products that cause damage. And instead, what their approach has been is precautionary. They try to have the government move in before a problem surfaces. And
so they'd rather prevent the problem than,
exactly,
than have a lawsuit once the person is maimed or sick.
Right, right. They try to prevent the problem from surfacing to begin with, and that is at the heart of our different approaches, is the Europeans try to prevent the problem before it surfaces, and the Americans have the ability to punish once a problem has gotten so bad that numerous people have already been damaged by it. Now, there's an interesting twist to that tale, because when I spoke to company representatives in Europe who were the European representatives for American multinationals operating in Europe, I asked them explicitly, I said, well, why does your company oppose laws back home in the United States that it is clearly willing to adapt to here in Europe? And the answer came back, and it came back numerous times. It was so interesting how many times it was repeated. It basically came back saying, well, we don't need those kind of laws, this strict regulation in the United States, because we have this tort system. And if we produce a product that is dangerous, we will be brought into court. It will cost us billions of dollars, and our shareholders don't like that to happen. That is what I heard numerous times. Then I came back and I started kind of checking around because I was interested about that argument. And I began looking into the tort reform movement. And some of you listeners might be aware of this movement to essentially reform the American civil litigation system. And that effort is targeted at this exact system that I'm talking about, which is the ability to bring corporations to court to pay damages for products that cause harm to individuals. And it's now called the tort reform movement. What did I find out? Well, I found out that the same companies whose European representatives were telling me that the important difference with America was that they had this tort system, so we don't need these kind of regulations. When I came back to the United States and I did some reporting, I found out that many of those same companies are significant contributors to the tort reform movement here in the United States. So what you get, again, is a dual universe where the word or the line or the explanation in this case is we don't need tight regulation because we've got the tort system. And then with its other hands, with its political PACs and such like that, some of these very companies are funding the effort to dismantle that legal system.
You wrote a book called Circle of Poison, co-wrote this book about 25 years ago, in which you exposed the situation of the United States exporting toxic chemicals, pesticides, and so on, which had been banned in the United States, exporting those to other countries, third world countries with lower environmental standards. Now we're in almost the opposite situation in which some of our standards are far behind not only European countries, but even Mexico and some African countries.
Yeah, you know, it's incredible. It's incredible. There's been such an incredible retreat from environmental protection under the current administration that we are falling behind not only Europe, but other countries around the world, which are really trying to take seriously their environmental problems. We've had here in the United States drastic cutbacks in the enforcement ability of EPA and the enforcement ability of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, as we saw with the lead and toy fiasco. And while we're doing that, while we're completely abnegating a role of environmental leadership, the rest of the world is moving ahead. They're not waiting. So you have actually situations where the country of Mexico, and this happened about a year ago, banned a pesticide called lindane, which was actually quite legal here in the United States. And the United States finally actually caught up with Mexico, but actually ended up following Mexico. And it was amazing, actually. I talked to some Mexicans when it came to lindane. It's a very potent neurotoxic chemical that the Mexicans decided to ban about 2 years ago. And they were telling me that their biggest concern was that there would be smuggled lindane into Mexico from the United States.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so they were worried about smuggling from New Mexico and in Arizona and the border states in California into Mexico. So that was quite a flip on the head from the role that most Americans presume themselves to be in the world. And all across the board, what you're seeing, for example, in electronics is the European Union has banned numerous chemicals from being used in electronics, very highly toxic metals and chemicals, flame retardants.
Well, let's talk about that, because this is a very interesting difference. The European response to the toxins in electronics and in cars and so on has been to require a life cycle analysis of any product brought to market. What is this? How does it work?
Yes. Yeah, life cycle analysis really is, I kind of love the term. I thought it was kind of some Zen Buddhist thing that I hadn't quite understood when I first heard about it. And perhaps it is in that practice, but it's also, in this case, a ability to understand what the life cycle of a product is. So basically it's produced, and it is the traditional way to do it in the United States is you produce something, you use it for 10 years, and then you throw it in the trash, and then it's out of mind. But actually where it ends up is in some big dump somewhere, poisoning somebody with what's inside the console or the electronic circuitry or whatever it is. So life cycle is really trying to look at they call it cradle to cradle, which is essentially how can we produce a product that both you can, when you buy it, when you use it, and then you use it over a period of time, and that it integrates so many elements of itself that are kind of recyclable, that significant portions of that product can be recycled, and that those that cannot be recycled will not, at the very least, be toxic. So what they're looking at is the long-term environmental and economic costs of traditional production. So traditional production in the United States, basically, enormous amount of money goes into innovation and research. You come up with a new product, you get it onto the market, and then you don't worry about the cost 10, 20, 30 years down the line when the toxic components of that product begin to leach into the water and into the air and into the soil.
So well, are European producers then responsible? Let's say I'm a European television or computer producer. Am I then responsible for the disposal of that product?
Yes, that's the striking thing. There's a whole life cycle take-back program, exactly as you described, which is basically major electronics firms that produce everything from DVD players to televisions to computer monitors, printers. They are obligated to set up little stations at retail outlets across Europe where they are required to take back their products at the end of their usable lifespan. And once they do that, they then are obligated to recycle the components of those substances, which gives a very, very, very powerful incentive to develop new materials that can be recycled. It's an extremely, been a very powerful incentive prompting new ingenuity and new innovation on how to deal with materials and come up with more environmentally benevolent materials. Now, here in the United States, what's interesting about that is the major electronics firms, of course, are doing that, exactly that. And you go into any major retail outlet and you'll see a little take-back station in the back of the store. And the same thing applies to automobiles. Automobile manufacturers are now under the obligation to have 85% of the insides of the automobile to be recyclable. And the European Union has also banned the use of certain chemicals in automobiles, including cadmium and chromium and lead and mercury and a couple of other ones. So when you own an automobile, you drive it in, and the manufacturer is obligated to dispose of it for you in an environmentally safe fashion. Well, here, and we're talking about many of the same automobile companies, because automobile companies are international, as are the electronics firms. They set up these stations in Europe, and it's working very effectively. In the United States, those industries have resisted every step of the way setting up that kind of recycling operation. And my point in the book is to demonstrate how such programs can work and are working, and to take on directly the economic argument here that these things are unreasonable and unfeasible. And I show in cases like the one just described how what is being told, what Americans are being told is unrealistic, is exactly what's happening in an economy and in a population that is as comparable to our own as you could possibly get.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by Garcia Street Books and their owners Eva and Edward Borens, celebrating more than 30 years as booksellers. Located at 376 Garcia Street, where adventurer Peter Heller will celebrate the publication of his newest book, The Whale Warriors, The Battle at the Bottom of the World to Save the Planet's Largest Mammals, on Monday, October 1st at 5 p.m. More information at 986-0151 or garciastreetbooks.com. KSFR programming is underwritten by Locals Care. Locals Care Community Cards reward you for shopping and dining at over 100 locally owned businesses. You can support a Santa Fe nonprofit and earn rewards for yourself at any Locals Care business. Find program information and a current list of participating businesses and nonprofits at locals-care.com. Offered in cooperation with the Santa Fe Alliance and sponsored by Century Bank, Los Alamos National Bank, the New Mexican, and the City of Santa Fe.
And we're back in the Santa Fe Baking Company with Mark Shapiro, author of the book Exposed, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products and What's at Stake for American Power. We're also joined by General Manager of the Lenzic. Bob Martin is with us.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Great to be here.
Great to have you both here. This marvelous book about which you were hearing, you heard a segment of the interview just a moment ago, can be yours if you make a contribution to KSFR. 428-1393 is the number, 428-1393, and from out of area, 1-866-907-KSFR. That's 907-5737. Mark Shapiro.
Yeah, you know when I think about the reporting on this book, it took an enormous amount of effort to do the reporting on this book, and so much of the reporting, the information I was able to obtain came from independent sources of information. When I think of public radio, I think of it as my primary source of news and information on the radio. And let me tell you, I work at the Center for Investigative Reporting, and we work with multiple mediums. And I've been watching step by step the constriction of the private press, as person after person, as talented reporter after reporter after reporter get fired by by private companies.
By private companies, you mean private companies like the New York Times, like, the Washington Post, the LA Times
has been devastated lately. Whole newspaper chains, of which I'm sure you have several here in New Mexico, massive constriction of the news holes. So more and more important in this country is the evolution of what you'd say nonprofit, public, community-supported news operations, because that's where we're going to get the news, because it's not going to be coming from the profit-making media.
Now, if you buy the local paper, you pay for it, and that's fine. But public radio, all you do is turn on your radio twice a year. We ask you to contribute. You ask me to contribute maybe the equivalent of buying the paper every day, or maybe the equivalent of a couple of meals in a restaurant over the course of a few months. 428-1393, 428-1393 is the number you can call. Make a contribution in any amount, and that actually is the mechanism by which public radio keeps going. It is the fuel of this radio station. We simply cannot exist. We cannot keep going without listener contributions. You at home may be asking, well, why me in particular? Well, it's the same question that you ask when you go out on election day or don't go out on election day. Am I contributing to this democracy in one way or another? Am I contributing to something I care about? If you care about public radio, you go to your telephone and call 428-1393.
Mary Charlotte?
Yes.
Got some thank yous here.
Oh, goody.
Marion Seymour, thank you so much, Marion.
Thank you.
Lori Lieberman?
Oh, thank you
so much. Pamela Epple, thank you very much. Denny Cope, thanks Mary Charlotte for herself, for being you. Thanks for being you.
Can't help it.
And what KSFR does for Santa Fe. And also Ginger Hart, thank you all very much.
Thank you all. That means the phones have been ringing. 428-1393 is the number, 1-866-907-KSFR, which is stands for 90.7 KSFR. We're just going to take another 30 seconds to hear from Bob Martin. What do you think about KSFR? How does it contribute to what you do at the Lensic?
Well, I think Santa Fe is incredibly fortunate to have a station like KSFR, because you certainly cover the scope of what we're proud of in this community, and that's the social activism, that's the arts and culture, that's, I think, people thinking passionately about the issues of the day. And I think it's just an incredible station. I think the way you guys have grown and the way you support what's going on in this community deserves everybody's support out there.
428-1393, if you agree with what Bob Martin just said. We're going to continue with our interview with Mark Shapiro on his book, Exposed, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products and What's at Stake for American Power. And if you like the book or are interested in it, call 428-1393. If you love public radio, call, and we'll be back. Tell us about the 1976 Toxic Substances Control Act here in the United States. What did it do and what did it not do?
Boy, that's a huge question. And what's called TSCA, let's call it TSCA, Toxic Substances Control Act, those were in the days when actually the United States was at the lead of, and even was at the environmental lead in the world at that time, back in the 1970s. And we were the first country to pass a law regulating chemicals, really pretty much anywhere in the world. You'd had this profusion of chemicals come into the marketplace after World War II that had not been looked at. Nobody really understood what they were. And so this was the first law to really begin to analyze chemicals. However, that law, which was passed in 76 and took effect in 1981, basically exempted all existing chemicals on the market from testing. So basically what you had, it sounds really great, we were the first country to do it, but basically it exempted all chemicals that are already being sold on the market were exempted, and its requirements for testing applied only to chemicals that were introduced from 1981 on. So what do we have 25 years later? Is we have some 90% of the chemicals on the market today have never been tested, have never been assessed for their toxicity, have never gone through the rigorous testing that TSCA requires for new chemicals. Why? Because the chemical industry figured, well, if we can just get away with having a bunch of old chemicals on the market, we don't have to innovate and develop any new chemicals. So that's what's happened. And that's one of the reasons the United States is now falling seriously behind Europe and other parts of the world, because our chemical industry has been under no obligation to innovate less toxic alternatives. Now, what happened in Europe? The Europeans looked at this situation. Back in the 70s, This is why my book has the subhead, and what's at stake for American power, because I think this issue of environmental health really ultimately gets down to questions of power and how you act on the harms we clearly face. So the European Union, which had itself modeled its own chemical programs on the TSCA program in the United States when the U.S. was the clear leader in the world, began looking at the flaws of this system and began looking at these skyrocketing rates of breast cancer, skyrocketing rates of infertility among young women, of endocrine-disrupting conditions, and began drawing some links with the chemicals that are now in the marketplace. And so they basically imposed a law, which actually took effect last June, which is called REACH, R-E-A-C-H, and it's a long, it stands for something long, I won't go into it.
Registration, Evaluation, and Authorization of Chemicals.
Thank you. You did that very elegantly. So this law, which you so eloquently just flew off your tongue, now is in effect in Europe, and there's an office in Helsinki, Finland, that is now requiring chemical manufacturers that want to sell chemicals and products that contain chemicals in Europe that must now be submitted for registration and assessment of their toxic qualities. And if they turn out to be potent endocrine disruptions or carcinogens, there are mechanisms at work to phase them off the market. So now suddenly you have a situation where the European Union has gone much, much further than the United States. We are left with an old archaic system, which has not stimulated innovation or promoted kind of new ideas in chemistry at all. And the Europeans are rapidly moving ahead of us in that area. And the other thing is that many other countries are now following the principles of the European REACH approach. For example, even in China, we all hear a lot about China and the devastating environmental conditions in China. I'm certainly not going to operate that, argue that that's not the case. But when it comes to production and chemical production, because China is now such a huge production center, they too are having to adapt the REACH proposals to their own chemical industry because they need to keep selling things to Europe. So in addition to China, places like Korea, places like Japan, places like Australia, even places like Mexico are beginning to integrate elements of the REACH concept into their own regulatory structures. And what that's doing is isolating the United States and the world with a kind of an old-fashioned system that does not really respond to the knowledge we now have about the potential dangers of chemicals.
And it does make you shudder to think what you have in the cabinet under your kitchen sink and in the bathroom. Let's move on to the question of genetically modified foods. There's been a robust movement in Europe against them, and you describe in your book an amazing moment in which French farmers go to fields planted with Monsanto genetically modified corn. They rip it out from the roots. But even more amazing than that scene was what happened to them when they were prosecuted.
Yeah. That was an extraordinary scene. And you basically have a grassroots movement of farmers all around Europe, and it's basically centered in France, but it emanates from there, of farmers who are resisting actively the spread of genetically modified seed into their agricultural growing regions. So Americans basically don't hear about these very much, but really on a weekly basis, you're having like even assaults against testing facilities for GMOs, large protests by farmers and consumers essentially all over Europe, basically saying, we don't want this technology, which has not been tested, planted right into our fields where we've been growing food for hundreds of years. So the French, this fantastic story where the southwest France, one night in early August of 2006, some farmers went into a test facility run by Monsanto, the American company Monsanto, and it was a couple acres big, and just started tearing up the plants. And started tearing them up, and they're part of a group of activist farmers, all of whom are kind of small farmers, small to medium-sized farmers, and they call themselves, I won't give you the French because I'll botch the accent, but it's called the Collective of Voluntary Reapers. So they basically see themselves as going out and they do kind of preventive harvesting of crops is how they look at it, direct action. And in this case, before the genetically modified corn could reach fruition, they went into that field and tore up like hundreds and hundreds of plants. It was late at night. It was about midnight. It was quite a dramatic tale. And then what happened was interesting. They were very public about their act. They gave their names. They didn't try to hide. And sure enough, they were arrested. It was about 42 farmers. And they had an argument in court about this was in Orleans in France. And the verdict that came down was an extraordinary verdict because the judge accepted what it was that the farmers had argued. And they'd argued that they had engaged in an act of civil disobedience to protect a system that they had relied on for their lives for centuries.
It was like self-defense.
Self-defense, exactly. That they were engaged in an act of self-defense against a new technology that threatened to destroy their way of life. And this was an extraordinary development. It had never happened before that somehow an attack on GMOs could be equated with an act of self-defense. And but that, however, is really how many people see it. They perceive their kind of whole way of life, their whole agricultural system they take great pride in, as essentially being under assault by this kind of brand-new technology being imported in by an American company. I mean, the striking thing was that this is an American company from St. Louis, from our own bread belt, moving American corn seeds into the center of French corn-growing region in the southwest of France, sort of between Orleans and Toulouse down there, beautiful, beautiful countryside, and attempting to sort of change the genetic configuration of a place where, you know, centuries and centuries of corn and other plants, a very abundant area, has been grown. So what you see is emerging an enormous tension around this area of genetically modified food, just like I described in the chemical area. And I described this in some detail in the book about how this battle over genetically modified food has really become one of the central disputes or a central way to look at the different means by which Europeans and Americans approach these potential dangers.
Well, the part of the problem here is that the farmers are unable to protect their crops from contamination from genetically modified crops through cross-pollination. And the great contrast is farmers in Europe are actually compensated when their crops are contaminated, while in the United States and Canada, the farmers can be prosecuted.
Right. Yes. What I do is I look at the situation, and what the French farmers were worried about was that the pollen from these genetically modified corn would blow into their fields and contaminate their fields with genetic material they didn't want. And guess what? That exact phenomenon has happened here in the United States, where organic farmers, for example, find that their organic crops are basically contaminated with genetically modified corn seed that comes from a neighbor's farm, and there's absolutely nothing they can do about it. And in Europe, it's been happening increasingly, this idea of contamination. The French wanted to stop it. Now, how do the Europeans approach this question? Well, they have a system where if a farmer has their crops contaminated by GMOs, they can get compensation because the Europeans acknowledge what that means. First of all, if you have GMO crops in France, there's almost nowhere you can sell your crop other than to be ground up into corn feed or something for an animal and maybe exported somewhere, because European consumers do not want genetically engineered ingredients, and many supermarkets don't even stock GE food.
And they require labeling, and we don't, so they at least know what they're eating.
Exactly. And they require, so everything that contains GE ingredients has to be labeled in a European supermarket, and here that is not the case, and in fact the industry has fought every step of the way to prevent that from happening so that we don't even know whether we're buying GE ingredients or not.
You're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. There is more from this interview with Mark Shapiro, but we are coming to the end of our show. If you would like to read the book, which Chelsea Green Publishing has been so kind as to actually donate some copies of it, you can make a contribution to KSFR by calling 428-1393, making a contribution. If you would like to listen to the whole interview, including the section that we didn't have time to play today, you can also call 428-1393, make a contribution of $35, get the CD sent to your house. Ladies and gentlemen, a wonderful book, a wonderful author, a committed journalist bringing this to you. Why don't you tell us how you feel about it? Give us a call, 428-1393.
A great interview from one of the best interviewers in the country.
Thank you, Dal. How are we doing? Have we gotten calls?
We have gotten calls. I have a thank you right here. Susan Harris.
Thank you, Susan.
Who's given in support of the cafe, but also for the Journey Home, World Music, and Democracy Now. Susan, thank you very much. And Vesta, contribution from Vesta. Thank you
thank
so
you.
Much as well.
And we need the telephone to ring all week because we have a financial goal, and if we don't reach it, we keep on asking you for contributions until they come. The great thing about being in community is that if everybody puts in a little bit, then we all survive, we all help each other, we all thrive. If nobody contributes, then we have a situation where nobody flourishes. So 428-1393 is the way you can contribute to this wonderful station, which I feel deeply honored and grateful on a daily basis to be a part of. 428-1393, KSFR is the station, and that is our phone number. If you want to make a contribution, we would be oh so grateful. I would like to make a special call out to those regular listeners who say, I like the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, I listen to it, I decide what I'm going to do on my weekend based on it. I sometimes decide what I'm going to read based on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. If you fall into any of those categories, please put your money where your mouth is just this one day and make a contribution of even $10 or $50 or $100 or more
means. I have one of those right now. Charlotte Cook. Thank you, Charlotte. Just made a call a moment ago.
Wonderful people out there listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, listening to KSFR. It's just about time to go. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me, and I do answer my emails as much as I possibly can, most of the time, if not all the time, at radiocafe at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to the wonderful Dotfoil Computer Services, who have set things up in such a way that you can, if you missed the show or part of the show in the morning, you can actually hear it on the computer by going to the website santafe.radiocafe.org. We want to thank Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the colors of jazz. 428-1393 is the number to call. Sorry I sound like a broken record, but guess what? Until you call, until we reach our financial goal, which is what we do twice a year, we go to our listeners and say, please make a contribution, kind of like passing the hat. Put your coins or your dollar bills in that hat. You do it not in person, but you do it by phone, 428-1393. You can also do it on the web by going to ksfr.org and checking that out. There's a way that you can pledge on the web. You can also send in the envelope that you may have received in the mail with a check or a credit card number. There are so many options for making a contribution to KSFR, but the one thing that's non-optional is that if you do appreciate the station, then please do make a contribution, 428-1393. And I want to send my special thanks right at this moment to Dal Dierman, who is a wonderful leader.
We love you, Mary Charlotte.
A wonderful manager of this station, and he's interrupting me because he doesn't want to hear compliments, but he is fabulous, has brought us from being a sleepy little ragtag operation with broken microphones to being really, that I know personally, these microphones, to being a wonderful radio station. 428-1393 is the number. Time for the news.
See you tomorrow.